Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner. In the news, we hear a lot about Afghanistan and foreign issues going on, but we've not forgotten about, but seem to think that the war in Iraq, we hear about explosions taking place, people dying, the focus isn't there. It almost feels like from our policy wonks that everything is okay and America is going to be leaving and Iraq's going to be fine. Well, what is really going on in Iraq and what has happened because and since of the occupation and what has happened since President Barack Obama has become president and where is this going for us and the Iraqis? The Future of Iraq report was put out, a 15-page report on the state of Iraq today, the danger signs that are being seen, and what our American policymakers need to consider from this perspective about the future of Iraq and how that affects our future as well. It was sent to us by a gentleman who has been on our show many, many times over the years, Dr. Adil Shamu, who is a senior analyst with Foreign Policy and Focus. He was born and raised in Baghdad, Iraq. He lives here in Baltimore now, where he's a research scientist. And Adil, it's always good to see you. Welcome.
Thank you very much for having me, Mark. It's a pleasure.
And other men who worked in this report are also joining us this hour. Dr. Sami Albana, who is architect of complex technology systems with extensive experience in socioeconomic development and the use of technology and accelerating change, is an Iraqi-American and is joining us by phone. And Sami Albana, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
I appreciate you taking the time with us. Dr. Tarek Ismail is with us as well. Joins us by phone. He's professor of political science at the University of Calgary. That is in Canada. He's president of the International Center for Contemporary Middle East Studies and editor of the International Journal of Contemporary Iraqi Studies. And Tarek Ismail, welcome. Good to have you with us as well.
Thank you very much.
So let's begin with this report, and Adil, I mean, I know you've been doing a lot of work on this, and I have a huge amount of respect for the folks at Foreign Policy and Focus. They come out with a lot of interesting stuff, and we've had a number of their people on over when issues come up. But this report, I mean, to talk about how this began and why these you and others who are Iraqis but mostly living here in America or living outside of Iraq came together to put this report together.
Thank you, Mark. But let me defer this question really to Dr. Albana.
Oh, fine.
Since he is really the official spokesman for the group, and he has started it long before he asked me to join them.
I'm a firm believer in protocol.
Thank you.
Sami Albana, please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you. Both of you are very gracious. The reason we started this effort, as a matter of fact, goes back to January. After the victory of President Obama in the elections, and he was getting close to really assuming the presidency in January 20th, and the whole purpose of it was, now that there is a new direction, then we should, as Iraqis who are committed to peace, social justice, and democracy in Iraq, put forward ideas that we felt are upheld by many Iraqis, because many of us have, you know, a huge network of Iraqis living everywhere, including in the Middle East, and we felt that their voice should be heard as an alternative to all the options that are now that were placed at the time. So, as we started working on this report and we issued our first report in May, it became increasingly clear that the policy assessment that the Obama administration went through and now is pursuing, in a way, achieved certain positive things from our perspective, i.e., the declaration by the president that they will definitively withdraw all U.S. forces, all U.S. fighting forces in December 2011. But basically suffered from a significant flaws in the political logic that is being applied today. Fundamentally, the logic that is being pursued, which we think is flawed, is that victory is at hand, that legitimacy has been established in Baghdad. There is a constitution, there is a government, and so on. And these are the constitution and the government of Iraq. And that based on this, all agreements signed with that government, all arrangements signed with that government are both legitimate, including the SFA and the SOFA. And third, that by derivation, political conciliation is a necessity, but only in the context of accepting that political process. And we felt that that is really, to some degree, a delusion, because the issue that is really at hand is that Iraq was illegitimately invaded, was occupied illegally, and that many of the arrangements, including the political process, were born in the womb of an occupation, not a form of consensus. The absence of Iraqi consensus basically brings with it an escalation of conflict, which we're seeing its resumption now in terms of bombing and so on, which, you know, unfortunately killing innocent civilians day in and day out. And we felt that we should really put forward another concept for approaching the resolution in Iraq, both in the interest of the Iraqi people as well as in the strategic interest of the United States, which definitively doesn't want to leave the area with a lot of people bitter and against its broad policies in the Middle East.
Now, what you just outlined, Sami Albani, is, I mean, really significant. I want to kind of parse some of it out and talk about the details in this report. And I know that the report was kind of an overview, and it wasn't a detailed report, but it was an overview. But I'd like to talk about some of the details from your perspective, from the three of you, and also invite our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888. We have been covering the Iraq war on this show since a year before it started, as we knew it was about to happen. And I would say, again, Adil Shamu has been part of this discussion for a long time. We want to hear your thoughts on where you think America should go now with Iraq.
Just an extension of that, if I may. This is Tariq Ismail. My interest, obviously, was awakened by the group's early activities and Samuel Benes, or Dr. Benes, basic interest and energy, and, of course, Dr. Adil and the rest. There is a professional side to it in my case. I am a political scientist. I am a specialist in the area of the Middle East. I was struck by what I call the poverty of the academic community and the limited, if not nil, contribution they have made to the understanding of the region as a whole and Iraq in particular. And that really struck me much more than anything else, looking at the shells and what's being written until the occupation. And then the complete, ignorance of the policymakers and those who happen to be associated with giving advice pushed me into really trying to do something. And since that was the base of a lot of the decisions, I felt it is my duty as a scholar, as a North American, if you will, person, and as a human being, is at least to pinpoint the fallacies, if not the straightforward invented analysis of that country. We were so unbelievably naive, if not stupid, in what we have written on that country. I mean, there are 2-3 basic myths that are thrown at us everywhere we even see academic presentations of Iraq, chiefly among them that Iraq really is a new country invented after the collapse of the Ottoman Empire by the amalgamation of the three basic ex-provinces of Iraq, and thus it's basically an artificial state. This is unbelievably naive. If you look at the history of Iraq, its foundation until today, you will be amazed to find out that today's boundaries are almost the same boundaries of that country, Mesopotamia, 7,000 years ago. So this is one. The other thing is the oversimplification of the complexity of Iraqi society, and it is a social mosaic. I would not say cultural. It's much, much bigger than cultural. And if you look at it, that country had what they call, what we call nowadays, cultural minorities that don't exist anywhere else. For example, we have some Babylonian foundation of certain social groupings in that country. And then this whole idea of only Kurds, Arabs, and Kurds and Shiis and Sunnis. I mean, here is another fallacy that we still use. I mean, if you're talking about ethnic division, well, then you go Arab and Kurds. If you're talking about religious division, then you talk about Muslims and non-Muslims. To combine all these in a very confused way and produce them as if they are legitimate attempts to explain the complexity of that society, to me, at best, is false, if not misleading, with clear intention of doing this. So when you look at that, and we build our analysis on all this, and as Dr. Al-Banna and Dr. Shamir said, we were expecting a new leadership that is intelligent, that is at least reasonable, and hopefully will be looking at the issues from a different perspective. We all felt, and again, the gratitude here for our two colleagues there, that we must do something and at least try to explain the realities.
Adel?
Well, I think what they are emphasizing, that the foundational... excuse me.
Have some water.
The foundational infrastructure by which Iraq and our country now is promoting is really weak, and it could crumble at any moment. And the Obama administration, and for full disclosure, I supported him very strongly, and I'm still hopeful and supportive, is built really on the Bush administration's mentality and what they have created. They have created basically an infrastructure based on sectarianism, on religious differences, and sectarianism. All that combined with the damage ensued to Iraq after the invasion, this is a country will not survive unless we restart the clock, basically. Remember the Obama administration's, they're going to reset the button? Well, Iraq needs reset button. The Obama administration should not purely follow what has been called the surge resulted in all these things, these good things. Well, they are not really good things yet. It's, you see, daily there are 20 to 50 killed, somewhere about 100, maybe even more, wounded. But the Iraqis' resiliency has really been incredible, eye-opener for everyone. And as you may have read recently, that what we call them Shiite in the American media, they have refused to engage in this killing and counter-killing, which is remarkable in this day and age, despite that the whole governing structure in Iraq is based on religious differences and sectarianism.
Well, I'm going to ask some specific questions to the three of you, because I think that about how you get to the point you say we need to get to. And let me just start a little further back. And we're again talking to Adel Shamu, Sami Al-Banna, and Tarek Ismail, who put out part of the group that put out the report, The Future of Iraq, North America, Iraqis living in North America who are very concerned about the policy and where it is leading our country in Iraq, and have put out this report. And they've joined us here today, and you can join us at 410-319-8888 or write to us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Now, I have not talked to Sami Al-Banna or Tarek Ismail before today, but you and I have talked a great deal, and I've talked to one of your colleagues, Tarek Ismail in Canada, Tabit Abdullah. In Toronto, has been a guest on the show many times. I have great respect for his work and his mind. And I know that Tabit and you, Adel, were opposed to the occupation and the war against Iraq from the beginning, that this was not the way. And I will assume that Sami Al-Banna and Tarek Ismail as well.
That's correct. Yes.
Absolutely.
Well, then, but in the report you have, this is the contradiction I'm trying to figure out. You opposed the occupation, and then I did too. Many of us did think this is the wrong way to go. But on the one hand, you say America must leave and close its military bases and turn the embassy into a university and end that compound and bring the troops home. On the other hand, you're saying now, though, because of what's happened, America just cannot withdraw willy-nilly. It has to wait before it can withdraw.
No.
I want to understand exactly what everybody's being. Who's that on the phone? Is that Tarek Ismail?
That's Sami.
Sami, go ahead. Sami, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, sir. Thank you, sir, for pointing that out, because what we are saying is that by the arrangement of the occupation is illegal, and that the United States has recognized this and is going to withdraw its forces. However, the exit from Iraq has to be done in a way in which the responsibility and the image of the United States are preserved. The reason is, if the United States is not cautious about how it will withdraw in Iraq, from Iraq, it will commit exactly the augmented, if you like, strategic mistake of withdrawing willy-nilly from Iraq. And the thinking behind the report is that it says, look, in order for the United States to withdraw and leave behind a mechanism that can work with security and so forth, it has to recognize that itself, the United States, cannot assume at the same time an occupier position as well as a conciliator position. It is trying to do both today, in today's policy. And that will lead to another explosion. That will lead to another civil war. Today, in the New York Times, there is a report about the Kurds and the Arabs and how civil war from the Department of Defense.
Yes, I saw that.
Right. Now, the reason for all of this is the United States insists on assuming that it can conciliate between different parties, even though it had favored some, fought with others, and have refused to really follow a very prudent process for handing over power. And the prudent process we recommend is internationalization, an international transitional authority, and we could work it out with the UN or some other mechanism. The United States will continue to be in the picture. It is the major power on Earth and in Iraq as well as in the Middle East. But it will include other parties that have legitimacy in bringing out a conciliation between the two. If the United States continues on its path, definitively within a year or after this election proposed for the end of January, what will happen is there will be a majority of Iraqis who feel disenfranchised, and that the parties that are sectarians and that are chauvinistic and that are fighting a religious war and all of that will remain as the power base in Iraq. And what we're really saying is, look, without bringing those parties together in a peaceful process, and one of the things we call for that is that parties should come to the negotiation on the assumption that they will emerge a political process that renounces violence to settle political disputes.
But I'll go ahead.
As you know, I have opposed the invasion of Iraq, but at the same time, I have never called for a precipitous withdrawal. I said it has to be done orderly for the safety of Iraqis as well as for the safety of American troops. We have 300,000, over 300,000 personnel, 130,000 military and the rest contractors. If you decide today you want to withdraw all of them today, you cannot withdraw them less than 6 months. So there has to be a responsible withdrawal. And we are calling between a year to a year and a half as the agreement between the Iraqis and American for withdrawal. What we are also interested, at least I am, and I think my colleagues will share with me, is to have Iraq not to become a puppet for Iran, nor disintegrate into civil war. We would like them to become a pro-Western, pro-American, basically independent sovereign nation. There is nothing incompatible in the two things we want. I think it can be done. And it could be done.
Well, let me I'll start here with Tariq Ismail and go around the room. And let me just throw some of the issues out. I mean, I think that you have pointed out, Tariq, that and as others have in the past, that Iraq is an ancient nation, and this is not a nation which is founded because of the fall of the Ottoman Empire. However, one of the divides inside Iraq is between Arabs in general, Christian, Muslim, Zoroastrian, whoever they are, and the Kurds and the Kurdish people. And in every country where the Kurdish reside, Turkey, Iran, Iraq, primarily Syria a little, there is has been for a long time independence movements that want to create an independent Kurdistan, a fear of turkeys. Clearly, what is fueling a lot of what's going on in Iraq between the Kurdish people and the Arab Iraqis is the question of independence or autonomy for Kurds. And so, I mean, this is a very difficult issue. I mean, this is where the Americans were first. They are well armed. They have an army that is as least as powerful, if not more powerful than the Iraqi army, and many of the people in the early parts of the Iraqi army were from the Kurdish area. So, starting with you, Tarek Esmail, how do you even begin to overcome that issue?
Okay, first, let me again revisit that question. I happen to be half a Kurd, so you can tell me to yes.
By the way, so am I.
Okay.
I happen to be emotionally and complete support of the Kurds all the way through.
Uh-huh.
Ever since I was a grammar school student until, you know, mothers are powerful on the making of our own personalities.
So, yes, they are.
In that respect, I am much more emotionally and continuously politically supporting the Kurdish rights. But let me emphasize two things here. I don't know of any political party, Kurdish political party, the major and the others, in Iraq, who really called for the separation of Kurdistan or the Kurdish areas from Iraq. So that is not really in the cards.
Mm-hmm.
In the cards, maybe, some extremists, in response to some of the Arab extremists, i.e. those who came to power after the Ba'ath rise into Iraqi politics, 68 and up, these are reactions directly to them. Yes, in the past, there were Kurdish rebellions for so many good reasons and what have you, but under the monarchy and the genuine, if you were, Republican regimes, there were always attempts to incorporate the Kurds within the whole notion of Iraqi citizenship. And that's all the Kurds were looking for, to be treated equally with the rest of the country on democratic basis and give the Kurdish areas, Kurdish people, their legitimate, if you will, cultural and even historic rights. So the Kurds never really called for an independent Kurdistan. Some might have. Some, in response to others, became more converted to that side. But in general, the Kurds, and there were Kurdish prime minister, Kurdish ministers during the monarchical period, and there were under Qasim, by the way, the first genuine leader of the revolution, revolutionary Iraq, lots of Kurdish, if you will, cabinet members, and even in the so-called Supremacy Council. And then more importantly, people don't seem to understand that too, that Qasim is half a Kurd himself. His mother happened to be a Kurd. So when you look at all that, the whole response of the Kurds and the rejection of, if you will, the Iraqi state, when the chauvinist Arabs, represented by the party of the Ba'ath Party and later on, obviously, more extreme members of that party, that and only then they started calling, some of them were calling for independence. So on these bases, I think this has to be carefully looked at. And
say a few words about this, please?
Sami Albana.
Yeah, thank you, sir. I wholeheartedly agree that there were periods that where chauvinism, Arab chauvinism, were instrumental in repressing and suppressing the legitimate aspirations of the Kurds for democracy and for human rights and for political rights. Now, the issue, and that is not at least position as a person. I have been in that position nearly all my life. You know, a branch of my family is Kurdish too. But the issue is that how do we solve the problem? Obviously, when there is a conflict which is being agitated based on narrow interests of sects and religious groups, and nationalities, ethnic groups, and so on, one can argue very, very reasonably that the Kurds say, hey, we need to protect our interests in this kind of a conflict. And that's what the American policy has encouraged. We see on the other side, equivalently, incidentally, that there are Shiites who say, hey, you know, we are really too special and so on, and we want to have our own autonomous region in the south of Iraq. And there are other groups of that sort. I go back to the fundamentals. Whenever there is a bad policy which is discriminating based on all of these axes of separation, every group is going to fight for its own. The Turkomans are saying exactly the same thing as the Kurds are saying, is that we have to protect ourselves. Kirkuk and these other areas, we will fight and defend it ourselves. The alternative, please. The alternative is to stand up with saying, look, Iraq belongs to its citizens. Citizenship precedes all of these divisions. Second, there are fundamental rights for all citizens. Everybody gets those rights. They are not compromised because of the color of the skin or the color of the hair or the type of religion or the type of ethnicity. Third, yes, all of the minorities of Iraq, Kurds, Turkomans, Christians, Chaldeans, the richness of all of that, Yazidis and so forth, all of them have a right to express themselves culturally, socially, organize, keep their language, keep their specific form of religion, and so on. These are the foundations that will end this conflict. Otherwise, hey, if I was a Kurd and everything else is happening in Iraq today, why not protect my interests and to hell with the rest? Turkomans are saying the same thing. Now, incidentally, which is this is very recent and it's not very well reported here, Chaldeans and Christians of the north are saying exactly the same thing. We want our own region, you know, in the north of Iraq. I read there was a conference in Iraq, in the south of Iraq, okay, which took place about a month ago, in which people who had African blood with them,
yes,
which are about a million, okay, now they are calling for a separate autonomous region for those of this will never end. All you will do is everybody will have their own militia, everybody will have their own fight, because the foundation of a governance, a rational governance state that respects human rights, that respect all citizens, is not there. What we built was a monstrosity where everybody, you know, with their own little group can infringe on any other group, and we never stop that. So it's time to stop it now.
So an extension of that, if I may. I think Sami put his finger on the most important issue, and that is citizenship. Once we agree that citizenship is the basic criteria for everything, then we are, I think, solving the issue in accordance to what I think a clearly defined democratic base. Our biggest problem is when the U.S. entered Iraq, it dismantled the whole socio-economic political structure and empowered sectarianism, the rule of the country. So in a way, without the U.S. dismantling everything, and eventually empowering the sectarian forces, nothing would have been ended up the way it ended up. How do we, what should I say, put Humpty Dumpty back is another serious issue. There are two very important, in my opinion, possibilities that could be used. And I think Sami pinpointed the whole idea of getting, first, the Iraqi, if you will, constituency to accept that there is an American change in the policy toward Iraq. And that has to be shown and proven first by abandoning the old line of the neocons and, to some degree, seriously work on implementing a new direction, not a policy yet. The second, to do that, you must have those who are not involved, as Sami pointed out, those who are not tainted with the old policy. And the way it looks, there is a talk, but no actual serious consideration of that possibility.
So, we have to take a short break here, and when sure. I come back, especially what you just finished saying, Tarek Ismail, I mean, I want to kind of probe them. How do you get to the place we're talking about? Because it seems to me, and I'm an amateur at this business.
Hardly.
But it seems to me that this occupation has, in many ways, dismantled the country, that Baghdad was a city where, as I read the statistics, over 75% of the marriages were mixed.
That's right.
That is now maybe down to 7% at the moment. In the last statistic I read, that the country is that the oil bill has been passed, and that many people will argue, maybe it's too conspiratorial, but have argued that President George Bush really wanted Iraq was to control the oil, so they can strategically control that area. And it looks like that is happening. So how do you get beyond the question marks before coming back? How do you get beyond the desire from scholars and intellectuals who were here in North America to look at a new Iraq to get it to a place that is politically viable again? I wonder if we want to explore that with the three of them in return. We'll be right back to continue this conversation with Iraq and the future of Iraq. You can join us here at 410-319-8888. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Heart Center, where expert cardiologists, cardiac surgeons, nurses, and support staff have a nationally recognized program focused on prevention, treatment, and rehabilitation. For a virtual tour of the Heart Center, go to www.umm.edu/heart. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner, and the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. We're talking about Iraq. We're talking about Iraq with three men who helped put together a study and report on the future of Iraq. And they join us here. Dr. Adil Shamouz in studio. He's a senior analyst for Foreign Policy and Focus. Dr. Samia Albana is an architect of complex technology systems with extensive experience in socioeconomic development and the use of technology for accelerating change. Dr. Tarek Ismail is professor of political science at the University of Calgary, president of the International Center for Contemporary Middle East Studies, and editor of the International Journal of Contemporary Iraqi Studies. Number here is 410-319-888. 8888 to join in on this conversation, or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. And let me start with you, Adil Shamouz. I mean, if what I posited before we went to break, which is all this sounds great. And I think that if you are somebody who didn't agree with the occupation, who believes in the integrity of Iraq and that the only stability of the future of that region is a stable, democratic Iraq that comes out of this madness, a flower out of the dung heap that was created. But how do you get there given all the things I mentioned and the chaos that Iraq finds itself in now?
I think this is still possible to move in the direction of democratic Iraq. And the Bush administration can play a major role.
Bush or Obama?
My apology, okay. The Obama administration. Thank God the Bush administration is over. The Obama administration can play a major role in basically moving this policy forward. What they have to recognize that the big footprint of U.S. occupation in Iraq still is one of the main causes of all the disruptions and destruction in Iraq. They need to get out of Iraq in an orderly fashion. That will remove a great deal of opposition and anger and hatred among the groups themselves and against us. But the same Obama administration, then within that framework, they have to internationalize transitional authority to the UN.
Let me just interrupt you for a moment.
Sure.
Let's just take that one point right there
sure.
that you're talking about, and that I think Sami Albana and Tarek Ismail have mentioned as well as in this report that you put out.
Sure.
I mean, politically, it seems to me the chances for an international commission or an international group taking over responsibility for transition Iraq is pretty slim, given the fact that the coalition that wasn't really a coalition to begin with has fallen apart. The United Nations is has a difficult time doing anything coherent at the moment. That it's, well, I mean, where's that going to come from?
Well, I think my feeling is that if the Obama administration and the Iraqi government, as flawed as it is, if they ask them, I think the UN could play a major role and they could take that responsibility. Sam, it looked like you're ready to talk, but go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you. I think these are very important questions you're raising, serious questions. Now, let me put some introductory first observations. The United States in the Middle East has tried and till now continues with the notion that overwhelming force is what keeps its power in the Middle East and its influence. And obviously Afghanistan is flaring up and Pakistan is flaring up, principally around the same principle. Yet the president has often said in his campaign and when he assumed power that they wanted to build a new face to the United States, to have extend a new hand. His speech in Cairo is an example of that, in my view, courageous attempt to extend a new hand. Well, the first new hand we want to extend to the Middle East is to change the image of the United States as a bully. And to change the image of the United States as a bully, his speech in Cairo would have been a great start if it was followed with practical steps. The practical steps, if Iraq now, I could tell you, you say it looks very slim, but look in the crystal glass for the next 6 months. If this bombing, assassinations, killings, war between Arabs and Kurds continued, I could guarantee you by November, 3 months from now, the United States will be calling on everybody in the world to try to help them calm the situation. What we are suggesting, okay, which is a very, or an alternatively, have to re-engage its forces in Iraq, which will become increasingly more difficult. What we are suggesting is the same policy. It says, look, you've got a framework, and the framework says the United States did go back, even under Bush, did go back to the UN, for example, to the Arab League, if you want. They asked the Arab League directly, for example, for a mediator. Now, go back to the United Nations and say, look, we are serious about opening the door for a peaceful transition to a democratic Iraq. The only opposition I could understand will come from few of the governing parties now in Iraq. But they are not the majority. Second, we're not saying exclude them from the process. We are saying, in the interest of bringing everybody in the process, open up a new chapter. Incidentally, if you go back to the legal foundation, you go back to 1932, under the League of Nations resolution, which granted, you know, the end of the British overseership of Iraq and established the modern state, you can go back to the council and say, look, we are in a situation where the arrangement established in 1932 are no more working today, and we would like to find a way, working with the community of nations, with all kinds of parties, that will open up the door for an evolution toward a new political process that will bring everybody and will prevent Iraq from continuing to be, and Adil pointed that out earlier, and so did my friend Tarek. Iraq, aside from all this killing and everything is going to go, the second dimension is it has become the playground for power politics and regional politics, not only for Iran, but Iran definitively, but for many other forces in the region, including Al-Qaeda. And our point is, unless you revert that direction, that will continue, and the hemorrhage and the suffering and the killing will continue to happen, long time will happen before this whole thing will overspill into all the countries of the region.
But I don't think, like you said, it's not going to be easy. Of course it's not going to be easy. If it was easy, somebody would have done it. Of course. But the Obama administration, with all its power, and other countries of the West, if they push for a new policy, a new beginning of a new policy, they could really move the world, especially when it makes sense, when the Iraqis, I feel, within a few months, they will realize that the Obama administration is truly sincere in withdrawing the troops. They are no longer occupiers, but they are friends and colleagues of the Iraqis.
That, I think, is a very important point. First, we have to re-win, if you will, or regain the confidence of the Iraqis that America is not an occupier and America is changing. And if Obama and the rhetoric of Obama is implemented in real concrete form, I think that's a good start. And there is something else you have to keep in mind, and that is there is a great optimism in the region, especially after the early Obama initiatives, i.e. the speeches in Cairo and the speech in Turkey and even the visit to, in some way to Indonesia. All these somehow gave Obama what you could call a very fresh beginning with a public expectation and more than that, the hope that America, the America that a lot of Iraqis respect, the America that a lot of Iraqis used to think of as the foundation of the so-called peaceful democratic world that was destroyed by Bush and the Bush neocons, that could be exploited, used, directed to start that fresh push that we need. Now, okay, you could say a lot of states are very much involved in Iraq in so many different ways, and especially in the West. Yes. But there are some Western countries that were not as deeply involved as the others. Take the example, for example, of Germany. Germany kept a very good profile and to some degree has a great reputation. We don't talk about it very much in North America because they were one of the first to oppose the American invasion of Iraq. Not because they like Saddam Hussein, just like all of us were active against Saddam Hussein. The fear was that once America gets into the quagmire of the mess, it would be impossible for America to withdraw. And that's why I feel if the U.S. is serious and go to the Security Council, of course I know it's very complicated, and put it back and say we're willing, but we need some international, if you will, force that could somehow step in and maybe readjust the realities and produce some sort of a peaceful, at least for the citizens, environment.
Well, I kind of want to challenge a little bit what you all have just said, but I want to go to the phones first and let some of our listeners have questions as well at 410-319-8888 as we talk about the future of Iraq, a report put out by a number of Iraqi scholars and activists in North America. And 410-319-8888, Greg in Charles Village, you're on the air.
Mark, I just want to thank you and your guests for talking about an incredibly important discussion. And I just want to say, I think you guys are saying great things, but I want to interject a comment that, and then ask a question. And the comment is, most of the discussion is about what Obama or the government should do if it wants to do the best thing. But if you remember the July 2008 New York Times editorial by President Obama, he said that he was going to end the war, but leave a residual force in Iraq. Since he's become president, that residual force has been clarified as up to 50,000 troops. So if you look at the military actions currently in Afghanistan, the increase of troops, the drone attacks, the killing of civilians by the tens or even by the hundreds in a couple of cases, I think it's on a fundamental level wishful thinking if your guests think that the U.S. is going to go to the U.N. and immediately withdraw from Iraq. So I guess the question I have is what could American politicians who actually want to end the war or Iraqi politicians who actually want to end the war peacefully, or activists or your guests, what could you actually do to bring about an end to the Iraq war?
If I may, please.
Is this Sami Albano? Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Thank you very much. First of all, I want to clarify to the honorable question that the report includes, incidentally, also demands that we are placing on all political parties in Iraq. So it is really an attempt also to move our Iraqi brethren, irrespective of their shade and political movement, toward recognizing that it is far better to establish a common political process than keep on fighting. The second remark I want to clarify is the declaration by the president, President Obama, on the withdrawal from Iraq did say 35 to 50,000, but that is 35 to 50,000 after August of 2010. In his own declaration, till the end of by the end of December 2011, the declaration and the announcement, at least, which was reiterated several times by Secretary Gates and Secretary Clinton, is that they will withdraw all U.S. forces by the end of December 2011. I wanted to make two remarks here, please.
Okay, then we don't have much time left. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. The quick remark is, there is no mention of the mercenaries, which are now 2-1 almost.
Right.
Which also have to go. There's no mention of the advisors. And there's no mention of the trainers and so on. What we're demanding is that they all withdraw. Second, what people should do here is demand that Iraq doesn't drop from public vision because we are digging another major conflict away from the public scrutiny of the American people.
Greg, your question is excellent. As you know, all of us who oppose the invasion, we voted for Obama.
Right.
And we want to hold Obama. We need to campaign, demonstrate, write op-eds, write letters to the editor, talk to our congressman. We need to campaign in order to move Obama in the direction of what we're talking about, of withdrawing completely without mercenary, without residual force. We want to hold his feet to the fire to comply what he promised us. That's why we all voted for him in mass, basically. And I am one of those who will be doing that, and I will hope you could join us in moving in that direction. This is why a year ago, and it's adopted by this report, I wrote in the Christian Science Monitor to have the U.S. Embassy as a goodwill gesture to be converted to American University in Iraq in order to start a new chapter in our relationship.
Now, I mean, we only have a few minutes left here, but it's clear. Two things are clear, though. I mean, one is the United States is not making any indications they're ever going to let go of the green zone. and they're just expanding it, not fortifying right. even more. And two is the question of oil, which is the question that's dividing Iraq right now and the regions that have oil and who's going to control and who's not, and the contracts being given out to Western companies. And
mostly American.
Mostly American, and that part of the process doesn't bode well for what the three of you are writing about in this future of Iraq. And I think we have 3 minutes left, so whoever wants to say something about that.
Let me just by saying, we're hoping that rationality will prevail in both Iraq and, I'm talking about the Iraqi population, not the puppet government of today, and the American government, particularly when there is a talk, at least serious talk, of trying to find a way to get out of the quagmire. That really means to me two things. One, the war is so expensive for the U.S. in so many different ways, human and actual, financial terms, that they will have to find a way, or will be willing to find a way, to get out of that, if you will, mess, as some have well put it. So I'm hoping with that, they will be looking for new, avenues for that possibility. And one of the only avenues that's left is to get the Iraqis themselves to be at least trusting for a future direction which America will be leading. And through that, you could get the international community in some way involved. Otherwise, it will not go anywhere. And oil, fine, but oil has to be produced. And to produce oil, you have to have stability. And the way things are going, the stability is not there. And the oil production of Iraq today is much lower than it used to be under Saddam Hussein during the worst days of sanction. So where is it?
So we're just about out of time, but I want to thank Dr. Tariq Ismail and Dr. Sami Alban and Dr. Adel Shamu for being with us. You can go to our website, steinershow.org, and link to the Future of Iraq report to read it and see what it says there. And, of course, we'll continue looking at the subject as we have for a long time. It's vitally important to the future of our country and the world. And I want to thank all three of you gentlemen for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Mark,
thank
for
you.
Having us.
Thank you, Mark. Thank you
thank
very
you.
Much.
I do appreciate it. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Johns Hopkins Medicine. For the 19th consecutive year, the Johns Hopkins Hospital is ranked number one by U.S. News & World Report in their annual Best Hospital Survey. Find out more about the nation's top hospital at hopkinsmedicine.org. And the Mark Steiner Show is also made possible by Urbanite, Baltimore's free magazine of ideas and innovation. August is Urbanite's annual stories issue featuring fiction, poetry, memoir, plays from the region's emerging writers. Plus a sneak preview of the upcoming art season, a look at changes in troubled Sandtown, and tall tales from readers. Urbanite is available at over 700 locations in the region. Go to www.urbaniteBaltimore.com for a list of the drop locations. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Jessica Phillips and Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. Our interns are Brian Boone, Judith Lloyd, Devin Finley, and Brad Kolodner. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for public radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.